Good evening. James McCanny here, going right into the show. October 23rd, 2008. I'll be doing mainly the science topic tonight, as I announced on the webpage, and which will be a continuation of what I've been talking about the past 2 weeks, but I'm going to add some interesting ways of looking at this and understanding so that you, the general public, and the scientists also who are listening out there, will have a better feel for what would happen to Earth if a large celestial object came near Earth. Not a direct hit, but came near Earth. And so just to give you a quick introduction, then I'm going to go to a couple quick announcements and then into the main science topic. But tonight I'm introducing a concept called, of course, most of you have heard the term that I coined back in my early days, called action at a distance. When two celestial objects meet or pass each other, but don't actually collide, and actually, you know, what actually happens when this occurs in celestial mechanics, in the understanding of science of the dynamics of outer space. I was in the middle of discussing what action at a distance, that term I coined many years ago, back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, with the original publication of some of my work, when two objects pass by one another but do not collide, things still happen out there, sometimes very drastic things. So I'm going to introduce a what I call the disaster factor. In other words, now the past couple of weeks I've been talking about what if an object was twice as big as Earth, what if it was half as big as Earth, and came by at a certain velocity, at a certain distance, let's say the same distance that the Moon is from the Earth. And I was kind of talked through this, but I know as I would keep going and adding factors, a lot of people would get lost. And so some people will be able to follow this. Some people would tend to get lost at some point. And so as a summary, as kind of a number that would make sense to anybody out there listening, the average person on the street that's not necessarily good with numbers, for example, I'm introducing the disaster factor, or what I call, and action at a distance disaster factor. In other words, I'll define that and talk about it in the main science section in just a minute. First, a couple quick announcements. I want to stay away from political issues, and so I'm just going to give a little summary that basically the political system of the world, not just the United States, is broken. The world is responding a great deal to what's going on in the United States, and of course the United States has many behind-the-scenes groups that are creating trouble around the world. And a lot of countries are responding to this. So at any rate, the thing is, in my background, I've seen this happening firsthand when I've lived in third world countries. I see them coming in. I see them creating the problems. I see them putting the phony dictators up, or the phony democratic leaders, whatever you want to call them. But at any rate, I just want to get away from that and make one statement that in any political system, if greed and especially greed and the people who always want to run the show, when their motives outstrip the common good, then I don't care what kind of political system you have, whether it's democracy, whether it's communism with the socialistic government, whether it's democracy with an alleged capitalist system. I don't care what kind of system you have. I don't care if you have a dictatorship or if you have a monarchy. If greed comes into play, then it's all over. So and that's where the Earth is today. I'm going to get away from that topic because the more important topic that we have to concentrate on is how does the average person take care of himself? And that's what I really want to concentrate on. And a lot of people are interested in this topic of Planet X. And of course, there are many people out there in the astronomy world who claim that there is no such thing as Planet X, never could be, never would be. But I find it really interesting that NASA itself last year admitted that it not only has a program to look for Planet X type objects, but it expects to find thousands and thousands of them. It has already found probably 50 that would qualify as Planet X type objects. None of them on orbits that would come in and ravage Earth, but there are many, a myriad of orbits out there, let's put it that way, and sizes of these objects. So since they're just beginning to discover this with search engines, automated search programs with telescopes, etc., as they put more telescopes in outer space and dedicate more of that telescope time to searching for Planet X type objects, it is very clear, and NASA was forced to announce last year, that there are already dozens, if not hundreds, of these objects already cataloged, but they expect to find thousands and thousands more of them. So I find it almost humorous, comical, if not, that some people are still running around claiming that there could not be a Planet X type object. And of course, the Nibiru Wormwood object, there's a lot of confusion about that. Some people say it's on a 3,600-year orbit. Well, we have history going back 3,600 years, so it's clearly not on a 3,600-year orbit. But there are other things that have happened in that time frame. For example, Venus was a large comet, came through the solar system. So 2 weeks ago, I talked about the dynamics of Venus, a comet with the planet with a cometary nucleus the size of the core of planet of Venus. It's slightly smaller than Earth, it's slightly larger than Mars, and I went through a discussion of how it, in passing by Mars, it would have taken the atmosphere and then eventually the oceans off of Mars, leaving the red dry hulk that we see today on that planet. And as it came by Earth, since Earth has a higher surface gravity, as I explained in that show a couple weeks ago, because Earth has a higher surface gravity, we won the tug of war and had a tremendous pollution event. So at any rate, and I gave some factors, what if an object was bigger than Earth, smaller than Earth, and last week I went into a bit more detail, kind of in general, giving a hypothetical object and comparing it to Earth in size. What if this object were bigger than Earth? What if it were smaller than Earth? What if it came by the distance of the moon, not hitting the moon, but just at that distance? What if it came sweeping by Earth at that distance? What if it came by half the distance? What if it came by at twice the distance? What if it came by at the same velocity that our moon travels, which is around 2,000 miles an hour, by the way? And what if it came by at a much higher velocity, which is very possible, actually likely, with some object passing by in outer space? If it came at us in the solar system, it would be coming at a much higher velocity relative to Earth than if it were going in relatively the same direction as we are moving around the sun in our orbit around the sun. So all of these factors come into play, and so your head is probably spinning by now going, there's no way I'm going to keep track of this. So what I've done is I've defined what I call the disaster factor. And a disaster factor of one I will define as follows. Imagine an object in outer space, and of course if it's moving through outer space, it would be a large comet. It would have a big cometary tail. It would be discharging the solar capacitor. There would be electrical effects. There would be magnetic effects. And I'm not getting to that point yet. I'm still talking about simply the gravitational effects. And they are very important in understanding what the ancients saw. And so at the end of this program, what I want to do is put you down on the surface of the Earth, during one of these major disaster events and kind of give you a feeling of what it would be like. So you'll use your knowledge that you're going to gain during this show and what you learned in the last couple of shows to then understand what's going to happen to you. What if you're standing on Earth and one of these objects comes by? What are you going to see? What's it going to feel like? What's the atmosphere going to do? What's going to happen? What are the energy translations that are going to go on? Are there going to be earthquakes? Are there going to be geothermal events where geothermal energy is released from deep in the earth and comes belching out of vents in the ground? This type of thing actually happened, and the ancients talk about this repeatedly in all of the old texts. And they're very clear that this happens when the big comets come through the solar system. Now, let me just preface this with one little comment. If something hit us directly, say if another object the size of Earth hit us directly, it would be pretty much all over for Earth. But those events actually are pretty rare. The possibility of that is pretty rare. So the much greater possibility is that some object will come by us in outer space. And it's my estimation that this has happened hundreds of times in the history of Earth. And I want to give one little example. Of course, everybody now is talking about the dinosaurs the demise of the dinosaurs being due to an asteroid which collided with Earth. And this, of course, was started, 10 years ago? I don't know even how long ago it was, probably about 10 years ago, when Luis Alvarez and his companions were out looking at one of the layers that was on top of what they recognized to be the event, so-called event, that then layered on top of the dinosaur, the fossils, etc. So they said, it had certain trace elements that would only come from outer space, so they said this must have been due to a giant asteroid that hit Earth, exploded, layered the iridium materials around in layers around the Earth. But almost immediately there were some questions that were raised, and the story didn't quite add up, but it was actually good that modern science started looking towards the heavens to look for disasters. And of course, they've always stuck with this asteroid colliding into Earth story and then claimed that it was a very low probability. And now if you look at, for example, the Discover Channel, I saw a show a couple months ago where there were dozens and dozens of scenarios, like a gamma ray burst from another galaxy, and the Discovery show on TV had all of these potential disasters that could happen to Earth, but typically those are very low probability items. The real issue, the thing that has repeatedly happened to Earth, it is very clear from the geological record, is clear from the history books that are passed on to us. If you read the Colburn text, by the way, there is only one source for that. Look on my webpage from the Chaldean Trust. Don't be fooled by the imitation bootleg copies that are running around the internet, the disinformation copies, so to speak. But at any rate, the Bible, what we consider to be one of the legendary texts of the Western civilization, the Old Testament, is filled with stories of disasters of celestial origin. So for anybody to deny this is really denying our heritage, and as far as I'm concerned, pretty much lives in a closet all by themselves, because, as I said, even NASA had to admit that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these objects yet to be discovered, and they are planning very extensive search missions to look for these. Okay, so back to the dinosaurs. It's my estimation that a much more plausible explanation for the demise of the dinosaurs is a large passing celestial object. And during this event, by the way, Earth is generally pummeled with a lot of debris that's in the trailing, the meteorite stream, so as it is called, in the comet world. It's a large stream of dust, rocks, small chunks of matter, and then some fairly large chunks of matter, which are in the same orbit as the comet. And of course, if the comet came near Earth, Earth would in fact be pummeled by these objects also. So you would get a combination of a near passage action at a distance, and you would get the pummeling of rocks. Velikovsky talks about the right off of the banks of the Carolina banks, that there are elliptical shaped sloughs that are carved into the earth, and it looks as if a kind of like a shotgun blast of big stones or rocks came into that area. And there are many regions around Earth that look the same, where basically a big tracer of large rocks, kind of in a fleet of them, so to speak, coming in, hit one area and basically created lakes and ponds in the Earth. So at any rate, my estimation is that the dinosaur event, the extinction of the dinosaurs, was probably not just an asteroid colliding into Earth, but in fact was a large passing object, including a large barrage of rock debris, small asteroids, etc., that collided with Earth at the same time. And the reason I say that is because of the absolute devastation of the many highly evolved species that existed at that time. And so what happens is the atmosphere is drastically changed, either reduced or it becomes very much larger, it becomes very polluted, and the oceans create a buffer for this type of event. So the sharks and other creatures in the ocean that have been around and basically made it through all of these events over and over repeatedly, the ocean provides a tremendous buffer for this type of activity in the solar system, but the land-dwelling animals really don't make it through these events very well. By the way, my weather book has an extensive set of plates in it talking about all of the types of events that occur during one of these near passages. And if you have not read my books, I suggest you get the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes. The supplement to that is Surviving Planet X Passage. Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection is the third book. And then the weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, all of these written for the public, describe in great detail the basic science that is behind what I'm talking about here. But I will continue tonight talking about gravitational effects of large objects passing by Earth. So let me define now the disaster factor that is equal to 1. And many times mathematicians do this. Science, they do this in chemistry and natural science. You take 1 as what you call a normalized standard. And what that means is that this is kind of your measuring point. If it's bigger than 1, then it's a bigger event. If it's smaller than 1, it's a smaller event. So let's say a disaster factor of 2 would be twice as bad. A disaster factor of 3 would be 3 times as bad. A disaster factor of 1/2 would be 1/2 as bad relative to the people who live here or the species on Earth. So a disaster factor of 1, I defined, this is relative to an object passing by Earth. The object would be the same size and density as Earth. It would pass the same distance from Earth as our moon. One lunar distance, 250,000 miles. And it would pass with a velocity that is the same velocity as our moon, which is about 2,000 miles an hour. Now, if you combine those three things, that would give you a disaster factor of 1. Now, our moon, of course, is much smaller than Earth. It's about a sixth the size of Earth, and it's one-sixth the mass of Earth. And therefore, the moon, if the moon were just sweeping through outer space, if it were not our moon, and it just happened to pass by us in outer space, it would have a disaster factor of about one-sixth of one, or one-sixth the definition of what I'm calling a disaster factor of one. And so, actually, this kind of is happening all the time. And we call this the tides. The tides in the ocean can reach sometimes 15 to 20 feet. And it's very important to differentiate between tides in the ocean and tides in the land. And this is the moon gives us a very good example because it's a very real example. It's something that we see every day, every night, and we're very familiar with it. We're all familiar with the ocean tides. So let's just say that the tidal bulge in the Earth due to the moon in the oceans is about 15 feet. Okay, that's just an average. Sometimes it's more than that, sometimes it's less than that, depending on where the moon is in its orbit. But basically, let's just say on average that the moon is one-sixth the size of our Earth, and it gives us a tide of about 15 feet in the ocean. What a lot of people don't understand or realize is that there is also a tide in the land of about 1 inch. So that's 1 inch of tidal wave in the land compared to 15 feet in the ocean. So the land is not going to rise up to the same degree as fluid, as the fluid ocean. The other thing that you have to understand is that the Earth is spinning underneath the moon. So it's not really the motion of the moon that's causing the tide. It's the fact that the Earth is spinning underneath the moon. So for our example here, the moon is essentially stationary, and the Earth spins underneath it. The equator of Earth is moving at about 1,000 miles an hour. So the tide in the ocean, as it moves across the open ocean and then meets the shoreline, is moving at about 1,000 miles per hour at the equator. And so is the land tidal wave that is in the land due to the moon, but it's about 1 inch tall. So that 1 inch wave in the land is moving at about 1,000 miles per hour as the Earth spins underneath the moon. Now, let's replace the moon with, in our hypothetical example, with something the size of Earth. So that would be about six times as massive. In our example, now all of a sudden the ocean tides would be probably about 75 to 80 feet tall. Now that would cause quite a bit of problem because cities like New York City, Washington, D.C., Miami, the southern Dade County in Florida, the islands like the Florida Keys, many regions, for example, up to Houston, none of these places would be habitable if our moon were the same size as Earth, because the tides would simply go in that far. And then the tidal wave in the land, instead of being 1 inch tall, which is due to our moon, the tidal wave would be about 8 inches tall. Very interesting. We would have a lot more earthquakes than we do today. And we all know that the earthquakes can be triggered. Not all earthquakes are triggered by lunar activity. But with that constant movement of the Earth up and down, when the moon is above us and then Earth spins around so the moon passes on, so to speak, instead of moving up 1 inch, it would be 8 inches. Which is would really work the Earth a lot more. Okay, now let's continue with this disaster factor of one. So if an object were this, remember the definition of disaster factor equal to one, the object passing by, our hypothetical object, is the same size and density as Earth. It's moving by Earth at the same distance as our moon is from the Earth, and it's moving at about 2,000 miles per hour, the same velocity that our moon moves around the Earth. So that's a disaster factor of 1. And so you can see that that's about 8 times what the moon is doing every day on Earth. Okay, let's change the factors here just a little bit. And just if you're not picturing this in your mind, what I'll do after I change the factors each time is I'll give you a disaster factor comparison. For example, what if our Earth-sized object passed 1/2 the distance to the moon, all the other factors remaining the same? The velocity is the same. The size of the object, the density of the object is the same. It would have about 8 times the energy that it would put into Earth and about 8 times the tidal wave, because the tidal waves are related to the inverse cube, not the inverse square of the distance. And so those are mathematical terms. You don't have to understand them. But what you would want to understand is if that same object coming at the same speed, 2,000 miles an hour, came half the distance to the moon in that distance away from Earth, it would produce 8 times as much energy as the object of the same size of Earth at the lunar distance. So you can see that distance is a very critical factor. I'm going to take 1 second and get a drink of water here. There, back again. Okay, now let's move our object out to twice the distance to the moon. It's the same size as Earth, same density as Earth, same velocity, 2,000 miles an hour, but it's twice as far as the moon. Now it's going to produce a disaster factor of about 1/8 the damaging effect to Earth as our object if it passed at the lunar distance, the same distance as our moon. So you can see that now the Earth, if it were orbiting the our Earth or passing by, let's say, at twice the distance, at just twice the distance from the Earth as our moon, then it would have 1/8 as much effect. Okay, now I'm going to do something. I'm going to speed our object up. Instead of 2,000 miles per hour, I'm going to put it up to 10,000 miles per hour, and that's a little more realistic. That's a little more realistic than our relative to what we know in outer space. So it's going to be coming in at 5 times the velocity as the moon is moving. Now, what's going to happen? I'll have to do a little explaining here, because energy that is contained in this gravitational wave is related to velocity squared. So it's coming at 5 times the velocity, but the energy involved is going to be 25 times as much. So just that little change of changing the velocity of this object. So if we take our sample object, the same size and density as Earth, it comes by the same distance as the moon, but it comes by 5 times faster, it's going to produce 25 times the damaging effect in Earth's mantle and crust as if it came by at only 2,000 miles an hour, the same velocity that the moon is moving. Okay, now I'm going to divert just a little bit here. I'm going to talk about the difference between fluids like water and the mantle or the land of Earth. I'm going to talk about tsunamis in the water and tsunamis on land and tell you what the difference is. Now, as you could see, the tidal wave due to the moon was 15 feet, whereas the tidal wave of the moon in the ocean tide is about 15 feet. It was only 1 inch in the land part of Earth, in the mantle and in the crust of Earth. it only moves about 1 inch. But let's look at something else. How much energy is transferred in that motion? And it turns out that waves and water are very fluid. In other words, the water pulls up, it drops back down, and very little energy is absorbed in the water. As that wave passes along, say the tide as it moves across the Atlantic Ocean at 1,000 miles an hour, very little energy is absorbed by the water. In other words, that energy wave continues to pass on until it hits shore. And the shore is kind of a stopping point. The tide comes in and then it goes back out. It kind of reflects off the shore, so to speak. But let's look at the energy in the land. The land rises up only 1 inch, but now land is not a fluid. So that's a big difference. That's why the land is not going up 15 feet. It's only going up 1 inch, but the amount of energy transferred into the land from that passing gravitational wave is very, very high. Now you have other problems with land in that you have structures in the land. You have iron deposits, you have metal deposits, you have the roots of volcanoes, etc., that are down in the crust and the mantle of the Earth. And so when this gravitational wave hits those, it interacts with those as if it were a shoreline, an obstruction. So the energy is absorbed there. So the tidal wave going through land dynamically is totally different than the tsunami, so to speak, that is introduced into water, because the land absorbs a lot more energy. This is extremely important. So take our example of the Earth-sized object, once again, passing one-half the distance to Earth. Now, let's bring it in. Let's bring it one-half the distance of the Moon. That was a factor of 8. And let's make it go at 10,000 miles an hour instead of 2,000 miles an hour. That's a factor of 200. That is a disaster factor of 200. You combine 8 times 25, that's 200. So an Earth-sized object passing half the distance from the Moon, going 5 times the velocity that our Moon normally goes, that is a disaster factor of 200. It would be 200 times worse than if the object passed at the same distance as the Moon and the same velocity as our Moon. So you're starting to see, understand, using this disaster factor, how important it is to understand. It's how close the object comes to Earth, how fast it's moving, and the relative velocity to Earth. Now, I am going to give one more example here. I'm going to kind of stretch this out a little bit. Let's bring our object in to one quarter the distance of the Moon. So this is a relatively close passage. That's going to give us a factor of 16. Let's make our object 5 times the size of Earth. That's going to give us a factor of 25. And so the end result, let me see, I'm going to calculate this out. This would be a factor of 400. Now let's kick up the velocity from the 2,000 mile per hour velocity to the 10,000 mile per hour velocity. That's a factor of 25, so we have 400 times 25, 10,000 times. Okay, you're starting to see the damaging effects of an object coming close to Earth. So let me repeat this last one again. The object is our hypothetical object. By the way, this is all hypothetical science. This is just using known standard rules of physics understanding tidal waves, understanding velocity, understanding how gravitational waves work. So our very last example, remember that a disaster factor of 1 is an Earth-sized object passing at a distance, the same distance that our moon is from Earth, and at the velocity that our moon moves at 2,000 miles per hour. In the last example, our object was 5 times the mass of Earth. It was 1/4 the distance to the moon, and it was coming at 5 times the velocity, so 10,000 miles per hour instead of 2,000 miles per hour, gives you a factor of a disaster factor of 10,000. Not only would it create tremendous devastation on the surface of the Earth, there would be tsunamis that of the ocean water that would simply inundate the land, wash over it, sweep mostly everything off the land, and the land waves would create tremendous earthquakes. We'd have tremendous volcanic activity. Probably every volcano on Earth would go off at the same time. And a tremendous amount of geothermal energy would be released at that time. So there would be many fissures in the Earth with a tremendous amount of heat coming out. If you were standing by a large body of water, say for example you were Moses standing by the Red Sea, as one of these relatively large comet objects came near Earth, it would appear as if the ocean or the sea would be parted and moved. Basically, what's happening is a vast tidal wave in that body of water is going to cause it to move, split, rock, and move in very unusual ways. What I'm telling you is that when you read Velikovsky, when you read the Old Testament, when you read the Kolbrin, when you read the ancient texts, when you read the true volumes that were left to us by the Mayans, for example, talk specifically about Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, which represents the vast comet Venus. When you read what they said the oceans lifted up and covered the land, and they swept the everything in their path away. We actually see this right now in Peru, along the western coast of Peru. They are excavating cities, entire cities along the Peruvian coastline, that they estimate housed about 40 million people. And were simply swept away. There's hardly a remnant. There's hardly a potsherd. There's hardly anything left there. And obviously what happened is the ocean reared up, came in, and simply washed everything out to sea. And I imagine if you could go down far enough off the coastline of Peru, you would start to find all of the artifacts left over from that big wash. Velikovsky said that on the western side of Peru, in the Andes, you would see ocean seashells that were originated in the ocean. So the question was, how could those seashells arrive up in the upper elevations of the Andes Mountains? You're starting to see the dynamics of these massive changes in the Earth, the Earth changes. These things I'm talking about are strictly gravitational effects. I have not even gotten into the electrical effects. I'm not going to talk about electrical effects at all tonight. I have not talked about them last week or the week before. That is a topic for future shows, and that adds an entirely new dimension to explaining. I'll just give you a little hint. For example, when Moses stood this was the Israelites leaving Egypt, the flight out of Egypt, as it is called. They saw a tremendous tower of pillar of fire, they called it. And these extended up into the heavens and into the sky. These were electrical discharges that were coming from the comet. Now, if you read my science work dealing with weather, you understand that hurricanes and tornadoes are driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere. So what he was seeing was essentially a huge, violent tornado or hurricane, or basically extending up into the heavens. And, you know, I remember the Ten Commandments when I was a little kid and I watched that movie. And they actually showed that as part of the movie. And I remember how graphic it was to see this pillar of fire extending up into the sky. And these are the biblical descriptions. Now you can understand exactly why they happened, because these were caused by the electrical discharges coming from the passing comet. But as I said, I just wanted to give you a flavor of the kind of things I will talk about once I get into the electrical aspects of a large passing comet. At this point, I'm just talking about the gravitational effects. And remember that when Venus the comet came by, its nucleus was smaller than Earth, so in our example, in our disaster factor equal to 1, the nucleus of Venus was smaller than Earth, and therefore its effect would have been lower on the disaster factor scale. So we don't really know how far away it was when it came by Earth. It seems apparent, though, that let me go off into another kind of a tangent here, because there's a lot of misinformation about pole shifts, and there's people who say, well, the poles flip magnetically, all of this. What actually happened is it seems that the comet Venus, the nucleus, came somewhat over the North Pole and moved our North Pole by about 30 to 35 degrees. So the old North Pole, the old North Polar Cap, what we now call the Laurentian Ice Shield, then moved down to where it is. The old North Pole literally was about the location of Ontario, up in central Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. And that's why it's very interesting to note that for example, I've done a lot of archaeological work, and if you go through many of the archaeological sites around the Earth, the ones that are predating the Great Catastrophe, or built on the gridwork of cities that existed before the Great Catastrophe, the gridworks of those cities pointed to a very different north, east, south, and west direction. Let's take Chichen Itza, for example. It does not point north, east, south, and west. It's about 13 degrees off. And if you look at the old north direction in the city of Chichen Itza, in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, it points to that spot in central Ontario, the old North Pole. And if you go around to the other cities, they're off by just a little bit from that, and they too, if you triangulate, you can actually show that these cities, the true north back at that time, was pointing towards that old North Pole. Now, when Venus came by, basically the mantle of the Earth shifted by about 35 degrees, and I go through a long discussion of this in my pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage. I've got some excellent drawings. It's rather hard to explain because you're dealing with quite a bit of intricate physics that occurs when these surface shifts occur on the Earth. So that's the book you would want to look at to understand the gravitational shifting of the plate and mantle on Earth as a large cometary object would come by. Now, the poles did not flip 180 degrees, and what we call Antarctica, the continent of Antarctica, was actually a subtropical, a temperate climate continent at that time, probably highly inhabited with people, and it's pretty certain that there were mastodons there. So the demise of the mastodons, the saber-toothed tiger, that entire extinction event was what went down as Venus the Comet passed by a number of thousands of years ago. It's probably within the past 10,000 years, and we know from the Mayans that there were two such events. I believe they were about 54 years apart. And that's why the Mayan religion, their calendar, is based on the cycles of Venus. And it took many hundreds of years for their calendars to sort out and for them to reestablish the calendars. And by the way, I keep talking about this, that when Velikovsky did his work, he wasn't talking about astronomy or celestial mechanics. He was studying calendars. He was studying the reason for the drastic change in calendars around 3,600 years ago, and actually about 3,700 years ago now, and because his books were written in 1950 and published. But at that time, it was about 3,600 years prior to him publishing those books. That's when the calendars of the Earth changed drastically, and he was studying that as a scholar and noticed that all of the civilizations, as they struggled to reestablish their calendars, all talked about Venus the comet coming through the solar system. They talked about Mars being a blue planet with a oceans being much like Earth. Mars was in quite a different orbit at that time, apparently coming quite a bit closer to Earth in its orbit. Venus, the comet, then eventually nestled into its current orbit, where it now resides, and the Mayan legend is very clear on that issue. The Mayan legend says that Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. And that's one thing I always want to clarify, that the Mayan calendar, the true Mayan calendar, has nothing to do with 2012 or any of this other stuff that people are touting on the internet today. The Mayan calendar is based on the cycles of Venus. The Aztec calendar in Mesoamerica was the first calendar to deal with sun and moon structure. The Mayan calendar was strictly based on the cycles of Venus. And so, that's not the point of this show. The point of this show is to give you an understanding of what it would be like to have a large celestial object come by Earth. Now, as I said at the beginning of the show, let's put ourselves down on Earth here. You are standing here. An object is spotted in outer space, a large comet. This is not just your average comet. It's a huge fiery comet. The tail is lashing out. You can see it sending electrical discharges to other planets. Obviously, the weather is kicking up on Earth. The sun's weather is flaring. All of the normal complacency of the solar system that we see is put aside, and the solar weather, Earth weather, all of these things become rather erratic and violent. More hurricanes, overland hurricanes, these type of things would be on the increase, making it difficult to see. See, now that's one of the other things we understand from the ancients, is they saw these events coming, they saw the big comets, they saw the Earth changes starting to occur, but then all of a sudden the weather kicked up and they couldn't see much anymore. That's why the ancients talk about the disasters being sure but unpredictable, because they really couldn't see the heavens that well because of the tremendous amount of weather that was going on. But at any rate, imagine you're standing on the surface of the Earth and all of a sudden you notice that something serious is going on. You start to feel the Earth shaking. This is all over the Earth. You start to notice bodies of water moving back and forth that is just not normal. You start to see vents opening up in the Earth's surface with steam coming out in places where there wasn't any steam before. And I think it's interesting, even with small, relatively small earthquakes and earthquake activity, the fault lines down in Missouri, I gave a couple of shows on those a while ago, and I talked about how they observed that the river actually changed directions as it passed down through that part of Missouri. And so even small earthquakes, you will see the water changing directions, lakes disappearing, lakes developing where there were no lakes before. These kind of changes occurring as people are trying to keep their wits about them, trying to survive and trying to just maintain. There's an interesting story about the Greeks. And this is actually where Solon, which was Aristotle's uncle, went back to the high priests of Egypt and said, "Where do we come from? Where does the Greek nation come from?" And the Egyptian priest cults told him, he said, "You guys don't even know where you came from, do you? There was once a great nation of Greece, and there was another great nation called Atlantis. And they were warring at the time when the great disaster hit." And they talked about there being five other major disasters in the history of the earth prior to that. So at any rate, we know this from history. These legends come down. They're not fictitious. They're very real. But the one thing you have to understand is what caused these. The earth did not just kick up and do these by themselves. Modern science is in a state of denial, so you won't learn anything from them. But what you have to understand is there is a way of understanding that when one of these large celestial objects comes by, we are going to have a major pollution event in the majority of chemical structure in a comet tail is, guess what? Water. The Great Flood. The ancients talk about the great flood coming from above, the burning naphtha. Oil does not come from fossils. It's not a derivative of decaying fern forests. You find oil all over the world in great quantities. The Orinoco oil fields, the tar fields, just like the Canadian tar fields, that all came in from outer space during one of these large cometary events, and the great flooding that occurred around the earth, the Noah's flood. All of these things that we know from history occurred at about the same time, and it's very hard to put it together because modern science denies that anything like this could happen. And so unfortunately, there's a political interest in keeping the public stupid about these events, because the one thing that the leaders, who are very frail, they're very fragile, they're very paranoid, the leaders of the world that are in power today, the ones that run the Federal Reserve, the ones that run the International Bank, the ones who put our presidents in their seat in Washington, these people are very fragile, very frail, and the one thing, the biggest thing they are afraid of is losing their power. And the one thing that they all know would happen if the population of the world looked up someday and saw one of these large raging comets coming into the solar system, or a whole fleet of them, everybody would drop what they're doing. They would stop making their mortgage payment. They would stop paying their insurance payment. They would start taking care of themselves, because the one thing they all would understand is that government, that bank, whatever you put your faith in, is not going to take care of you at all. The only person that's going to take care of you is you. And so that's the one thing they don't want you to know about. So that's why they put up these phony Tier 3 astronomers that run around saying there is no such thing as Planet X. They want the majority of people very stupid when one of these events occur, because stupid people are very controllable people. So at any rate, you have to understand the context of history. You have to understand the there's a great effort to destroy history. There's a, when the Colbrin, when I first started announcing the Colbrin, I was the recipient of one of the first three copies in the United States, and I know who got the other two. So I know the original people who received the Colbrin in this country, and they're not the people that are trying to pawn off that imitation copy on the internet. There is a great surge in recent time to take the idea of Planet X and make it crazy, to make it unpalatable for the majority of the public. And the reason is, as I said, because the one thing that the leaders, the very frail, the very paranoid leaders of the world, they are preparing themselves with all the resources from our great nation and world. They're building cave cities. They're preparing themselves, but they don't want the public to be in on it. When they come out the other side, if they do, they want to be in control of the world again. They want to pull the same kind of charade, the man behind the curtain deal that they're trying to pull now. They want to do the same thing, and that's a very interesting point, because if you look back in history, interest on loans, all of the things that are going on in economics today, phony money, phony wars, control of the public using phony banking, all of these things have been done before. They were done in the pre-catastrophe times, and they were outlawed very specifically. The way interest should be handled as a single usury fee, not this compound interest stuff that you see today. All of that was outlawed very specifically. And so that's another reason why true history is not something they want you to know about. It all relates back to these catastrophic events that occurred on planet Earth thousands of years ago. And the one major thing they don't want you to think about is taking care of yourself. They want you to be asking, what can my government do for me? What's the government going to do? And the real answer is, they can't do anything. Every time they touch something, they destroy it. So, anyway, that's the lesson you might learn from understanding the true history and the physics of how these celestial events occur. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.